and a good Friday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, X, and Facebook. Don't forget, you can take the show with you 24/7 on demand by checking out the Nick Craig Show podcast in your favorite podcast app. You can also listen online by visiting the website nickcraig.com. Our show this morning is brought to you in part by The Law Group. Visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. Melissa Gott and her team, or give them a call, 910-251-6088. Well, happy Halloween to you, and taking a quick look at the forecast on this Friday Halloween, it looks to be an absolutely beautiful one, and really the whole weekend as a whole. Yes, it'll be a little chilly once the sun goes down. It's only 46 out right now in Wilmington, but no rain today. Temperatures will get into the middle and upper 60s. Same thing, rinse and repeat tomorrow, and a little bit warmer on Sunday when we turn the clocks back. Temperatures, again, same thing, a slight chance of rain and some early rain shot as we get into early next week. But then temperatures rebound to get back into the 70s for the middle and latter parts of next week. So in terms of your trick-or-treating forecast, it is looking to be a really nice one across southeastern North Carolina. So if you've got any plans today, hopefully tonight, I should say, is probably the more accurate term, or through the weekend, looks to be a really nice one here across southeastern North Carolina. All right, we've got a lot to get into this morning. We'll be joined by economist Dr. Vance Ginn coming up a little bit later on in the show this morning. We'll talk about the Federal Reserve and their meeting earlier this week to cut interest rates. We'll also talk about the ongoing struggle that the Trump administration has with tariffs. We'll jump into that coming up here in just a little bit this morning. But I want to start off with an interesting interview. And this is something that we have heard before, but very interesting to see it once again. Andrew Cuomo, who people are familiar with, of course, former governor of the state of New York, a lifelong Democrat like his brother, like his father, nothing new coming out of Andrew Cuomo. However, he is running as an independent for the upcoming election in New York City, in which Zohran Mamdani will win. Now, some folks put that at the blame and point the finger at Curtis Sliwa, who is the Republican candidate, that he didn't drop out and endorse Cuomo. Cuomo ran in the Democrat primary, didn't win, and is now running as an independent because he, of course, lost the Democrat primary to a literal socialist in Zohran Mamdani. And we talked about this last night on our Patreon Zoom chat, which a great conversation last night. Great to chat with anybody. We do that once a month for individuals that support the show financially, a very small amount of money, $5, $10 a month. You can also set a custom amount in there as well over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. If you believe that you are getting some value from the show, the only way that we're able to stay on the air is thanks to our great sponsors like the Law Group and you, the folks that support the show financially. patreon.com/Nick Craig. We chatted about the New York gubernatorial race last night, and I've held the stance on this, and you know, it's a risk, it's a gamble, I understand that. I think Zohran Mamdani, who is going to win. I mean, I was looking at some polling as we were talking about this in our hangout last night. It's not a close race. I mean, you look at the mayoral race in New York City right now, and the latest polls give Zohran anywhere between a 10 and 15-point advantage. It's just not a close race as of right now. And the polling average, this is over at a Real Clear Politics, which is a phenomenal website for people that love digging into the data a little bit deeper. This is what the latest polling is, and the spread is over at RCP. Mamdani with a 15-point advantage went in that three-way race between Cuomo and Curtis Sliwa, who is running as the Republican candidate. So as Election Day rolls around on Tuesday, it is pretty much all but guaranteed that Zohran Mamdani will be the next mayor of New York City. And I have continued with the stance that while it is unfortunate that this is happening to New York, it's unfortunate that voters in New York City, not the state as a whole, but New York City, are determining the solution for them moving forward is embracing full-on socialism. And it's not a secret. It's not a surprise. Mom Donnie is not obfuscating his stances. He's not obfuscating the things that he believes. He is very unabashed about it. It is right up in your face. And for the radical progressives that live in New York City, that is who they are backing. Now, the downside, I believe, for Democrats is it is going to put somebody like Zohran, who, again, is a self-described literal socialist. All of his policies are wrapped around socialism. It is going to put him in control of, I would argue, the world's best and well-known city, the Big Apple, New York City. And again, while that's unfortunate for folks that live there, I think in terms of a political strategy for Democrats, this is not a good situation for them. Now, obviously, having a Democrat mayor in New York City is politically good for the left, sure. But this guy in Zohran Mamdani is going to be the figurehead and the face of all of the disastrous, terrible, awful policies that we know that exist on the left. And this is not just going to be some fringe, you know, city council member in some small city across America. No, this guy is going to be the mayor of New York City. It's a very important role, and he is, I think, going to set the Democrats back as we head into the midterm elections next year. So Andrew Cuomo, former governor of New York, disgraced governor of New York, running as an independent in the mayoral race. He's 15-plus points behind Zohran Mamdani at this point. He was on with Stephen A. Smith yesterday on his SiriusXM show. And Stephen A. Smith played a clip, I think it was either this week or last week, making just some ridiculous comments about what's going on with that big NBA gambling ring that was last Friday. But he does ask some interesting questions and has an interesting debate on his SiriusXM show, which we've played some clips from. He sat down with Cuomo yesterday, and I just wanted to play through this because Andrew Cuomo is saying, I think, the quiet part out loud. I believe that Andrew Cuomo is saying what is probably being said in highfalutin Democrat circles, the people that actually know what's going on, the individuals that know what is needed to have electoral success. This is a pretty interesting clip. I'll cut it off a couple of times, but this is Cuomo with Stephen A. Smith yesterday. Get a listen to this.
Thoughts about Governor Kathy Hochul endorsing him, supporting him. It's one thing for Bernie Sanders to do it. He's, you know, he's a progressive leftist and doesn't mind socialism at all. It's one thing for AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, doing the same thing. It's another thing entirely for your former lieutenant governor to be willing to do that. What should that say to New Yorkers in your eyes? How do you answer that?
They are, look, you have a civil war going on in the Democratic Party.
Okay.
You have heard me say this for years. And I am not tooting my own horn this morning. It is fascinating to hear somebody who, like Andrew Cuomo, who is a very well-known, and obviously, yes, he has his controversy and drama, but a very well-known, a very connected, a very plugged-in, a very respected Democrat in terms of what he had success doing in the state of New York. Andrew Cuomo is not some fly-by-night guy that just popped onto the scene 5 minutes ago. He wasn't a bartender 10 years ago like AOC was. This guy has, of course, a lot of this due to his father. His whole family has been very politically engaged and involved for a significant amount of time. And so when Andrew Cuomo is saying, we've got a civil war brewing in the Democrat Party, that is really, really bad news for the minority party ahead of a midterm election, which, by the way, is in 12 months, essentially 12 months from where we speak this morning. We flip the calendars over to November tomorrow. Tuesday is election day for municipals, and we are off and running in the midterm elections.
Okay.
You have this far left, extreme left socialist. They are socialists. They call themselves democratic socialists. Forget democratic. It's just a modifier for socialists.
Okay.
They're socialists. Bernie Sanders, AOC, etc. That far left is having a war with the moderate mainstream Democrats. I'm now a moderate. All my life I was a crazy liberal, son of a crazy liberal, but hey, the world shifted so fast that now I'm a moderate. Okay, so it's the far left versus the moderate. A lot of the mainstream Democrats are afraid of the left. So they think they're going to make peace by endorsing Zohran, and they're going to buy peace with the far left.
I'm going to pause this here because this is something that is always, this is something that has been a modern problem for the Democrat Party for quite some time. You've heard me say this in the past. The issue that Democrats deal with currently is the far left progressives are, while they're not a super large group of voters, they are a very loud group of voters. They are a very engaged group of voters. They are a very involved group of voters. And the concern has always been, and you've seen that this straddling of this line up in Congress in Washington, D.C., is if you piss off the radical progressive left, while you can still win elections, you are going to deal with an incredible amount of pressure because these individuals are very, very tuned in. They're very, very involved. And they're, if I'm being frank and honest, they're a huge pain in the ass to those on the left. I mean, they're just, they're a constant nagging pain. And so there's been this attempt to straddle the line in Washington, D.C. and around the country with, well, we don't want to piss off the progressive left too much because they're going to make a lot of noise and make our lives a living hell. So we don't want to piss them off. We still need them to come out and vote. But at the same time, we don't want to turn over the keys to them. We don't want to turn over the keys to the castle because we know that their policies are woefully unpopular amongst the vast majority of the American populace. And that is the civil war that Andrew Cuomo is describing. When you look at the policies of somebody like a Zohran Mamdani, a Bernie Sanders, an AOC, they are very unpopular. They may not be 80-20 issues. They may be more 70-30 or 60-40, 70-30. I mean, they might be somewhere in that ballpark. They're not 50-50 issues. They're not 80-20, but they're not woefully popular with the vast majority of the American population. And that is the issue that Democrats have, why they have to straddle that line. Because the ideas are crazy. The ideas don't work. The ideas are not popular when you poll all of America from sea to sea, from Canada to Mexico. When you poll the country, they're not in favor of state-run grocery stores. They're not in favor of ridiculous rent control policies that make it so that you as a property owner have essentially no rights over something that you worked very hard to purchase and upgrade and maintain. These are not things, free bus fare, free healthcare for everybody. I mean, these things are just not popular amongst the vast majority of the public. Yet these are some of the major rallying cries that you hear from those on the progressive left. So it has boxed Democrats into a corner. And by the way, this was all avoidable. This was all avoidable by the left. They had the opportunity a couple of years ago to tamp this stuff down, to squash this and regain control of their party, to put these radical fringe progressives in their place and say, you guys are crazy, your ideas suck, and we're not going to take you seriously. But as Andrew Cuomo, the former governor of New York, now running for mayor, just described, there was this attempt to build peace. They thought that if they were, you know, they were nice to the progressives, you know, give them a couple of drops here and there, sprinkle a little bit on here and there, that you'll win these people over. They'll come over to our side. They'll become more moderate, and then we can work together. What we have seen is that is not the case. What we have seen is that is not something that has worked out for the for Democrats, and it, I think it's causing them a major problem.
This is the moderate. A lot of the mainstream Democrats are afraid of the left. So they think they're going to make peace by endorsing Zohran, and they're going to buy peace with the far left. I have news for them. The far left is never going to declare peace. They're going to come for power, and they're going to come to kill them. But you have moderate Democrats who are just trying to make nice because they're afraid the far left is going to come after them.
Does the same in your mind apply to House Speaker Hakeem Jeffries?
Yes.
Does the same apply to Chuck Schumer at this particular point in time, considering we're living in a government shutdown right now? And 6 months ago, he was for the, you know, he obviously was for the CR and he voted not to shut down the government. But 6 months later, he's obviously elected to side with the progressive left. Does the same apply to him?
Look, it applies to all of them, Stephen A.
Okay.
It applies to all of
them. So where does that leave Andrew Cuomo?
I am saying I am not going there. That is not my father's Democratic Party. It's not my Democratic Party. It's not Bill Clinton's Democratic Party. It's not Barack Obama's Democratic Party. This is a socialist party. It would be the death. It would be the death of the Democratic Party. The Republicans are licking their lips, hoping this kid, Mamdani, wins.
Bingo. Bingo. That's it. I don't think Cuomo is just saying this because he wants to get elected as mayor of New York. I don't think Cuomo is just saying this to try and strike fear into Democrats. I believe this is the case. I strongly believe that what Andrew Cuomo just said is very accurate. Zohran Mamdani, when he is elected next Tuesday, is going to become the face of the Democrat Party on a national scale. I can guarantee you, in the RNC right now, even in the White House and in other highfalutin Republican circles, they are already working on and may already have done some ads, some social media posts, various things that is going to, and again, follow me through on this, Republicans are going to try and make Zohran Mamdani the face of the Democrat Party. Because it is clear and obvious, and we talked about this on our Patreon hangout last night, within 6 months, he is going to try and ram through as many of these progressive policies as possible. Because just like everybody else, he also has to deal with this far left movement within the radical base. It is a rabid group of individuals. It is a what have you done for me lately group. And so he's got to act quick. I don't believe he's going to be able to get into office and slow walk this stuff. He's going to have to come fired out of a cannon on this stuff. He's going to have to get these things implemented as quickly as possible to keep the radical progressive base on his side, because we know how quickly they will flip and tear apart somebody, even that they agree with, when they're not getting the results that they're looking for. This, I think, is absolutely the best thing possible for Republicans leading into the midterms.
Because they can pick them up and carry them around the country and say, here's the Democratic Party, 34-year-old, never had a job, wants to decriminalize prostitution, doesn't like the police, defund the police, abolish jails. Literally a socialist, anti-business, anti-corporate. Government should control the means of production. That's what their first motto. That's Marxism. So this socialist wing wins, the Democratic Party dies, in my opinion.
Well, there you've got it. The socialist wing wins, and the Democrat Party dies. I think there's a lot of truth to what Andrew Cuomo is saying. Let me make sure I'm clear with what I'm saying. I don't think that Andrew Cuomo is a true moderate. He is, of course, playing this up as he is down, almost 16 percentage point in the polls. So he's playing this up that he is, you know, the true voice of reason, the true moderate in the race. Andrew Cuomo is a progressive, but he's not a radical progressive. And when he makes comments, and this is not something new, you've heard this for over a decade at this point, that the Democrat Party of 10 or 15, 20 years ago doesn't exist right now. You've got some holdovers. You've got the Chuck Schumers. You've got the Nancy Pelosi's, the individuals that have been in government for 40 years, have been lifelong Democrats, but they're in a very tough spot. And as was mentioned by Stephen A. Smith in that interview, Schumer's dealing with this right now with the government shutdown. He knows that if he is on the floor of the United States Senate advocating for the government to reopen, passing this CR, he is going to get lambasted by the progressive left. He is going to get steamrolled by the progressive mob. He knows that that risk is real. It's partially his fault for not squashing this movement back when he had the opportunity to a couple of years ago. And the chickens are coming home to roost. And there's no answer. Because as I mentioned, if you piss off this group too much, they're just not going to vote for you. They're going to stay home. They're not going to vote for Democrats. And that is a block of voters that they need. While it's not a massive group of individuals, it's a large enough group to change an election. It is a large enough group to win an election for the Democrats. And they are going to need this group of individuals to show up heavy next year to take control back of the United States House. If you're a Democrat, that's what your goal is and what you're working on over the next 12 months. You've already been working on it, but that is really the goal and objective here over the next 12 months. We've got to get back control of the House. We've got to win the House back. That's the only thing. They're not going to win the Senate. Of course, Trump's not on the ballot. He's going to stay in the Oval Office. We've got to win the House back. How are you going to do that when you are having to play footsies with the radical progressive left? How are you going to do that when you are going to have Zohran Mamdani's face terrible policies, awful ideas on full display for the entire world to see? We're not talking about some mayor in some small town across America. We are talking about the Big Apple, New York City, the most well-known, prominent city in the world. And you are going to have a socialist Marxist leading that city. This is really, really bad news, I think, for the left. It could end up working out well for them. Just under kind of looking at what the information that's available right now, my stance is, and I want to make sure I'm always clear with this. This is not an opportunity for the right to take the foot off the gas. This is not a situation where Republicans should get complacent with what's going on. I mean, the Democrats are still a risk. They're still a threat. It's still a group that needs to be taken seriously because they are, of course, will be on ballots with Republicans next year. But I strongly believe that this is going to backfire majorly for them. That this is going to turn into a very unfavorable situation if, in fact, Zohran Mamdani plays out some of the policies that he has said he's going to. And from all indications, having watched a couple of the mayoral forums that took place in New York City over the last couple of weeks, I don't have any reason to believe that he is not going to follow through on the things that he talks about. He is going to jack up taxes. They're already sky high in New York City. They're already sky high in New York State. It's why you're seeing such a mass exodus from the state as a whole. You're going to see even more of that from New York City. You are going to see business flee the city. You're going to see wealthy individuals flee the city, which, of course, is the irony in all of this, right? Because one of the main platforms of these radical progressives is the wealthy need to pay their fair share. Tax the rich, eat the rich, you know, all of these fun sayings that they have. There ain't going to be any rich people left in New York City, folks. As you continue to kick up the tax rate, you will see more and more people moving out of the city for their primary residence. They go to New Jersey, they'll go upstate, get out of the five boroughs. I mean, there's a lot of other alternatives. Go over to Connecticut. There's plenty of other places to go. Now, New Jersey has its own problems. That governor race is actually pretty close there. Connecticut's issues as well. But it's not going to be anywhere near as bad as New York City. So you're going to have a bunch of people taking their money and running, rightfully so. And then you're going to have somebody like Zohran Mamdani saying, we're not going to charge you to use the bus anymore. You're going to pay for that as taxpayers. We're going to give you free food, free grocery stores all over the place. Taxpayers will cover that. We're going to defund law enforcement so that your city becomes riddled with crime. It's a disastrous situation. And I'm not in these circles, but I would imagine in prominent Democrat circles, they are pissed with what is likely to happen in New York City on Tuesday. It just doesn't, I don't know, I don't, I can't at this point to anything successful that's going to come out of this. We've got some comments coming in on our Rumble live chat this morning. Time for these Democrat socialists to get elected, and everyone will see this will not be good for New York City. Democrats and Republicans will have to unite. Hopefully this will be a wake-up call for all. It's an interesting point. And you know, once somebody like Zohran Mamdani is in office, which, barring some unexpected situation, is going to happen, it is going to be interesting to see what Democrats do. Right? Because even right now, you've seen somebody like a Chuck Schumer, like a Hakeem Jeffries, they're still kind of tiptoeing around the issue of Mamdani. They haven't come out and fully endorsed him. They're not slamming him, but they're not endorsing him. Once he's the mayor, these guys are going to be asked 24/7 about what he's doing. And so then their option is going to be either A, we support it, or B, we don't. If you say you support it, then you're just making the argument clear and easy for Republicans. If you say you don't support it, you piss off the radical progressive left. This is a disastrous situation of their own making, and I am very curious how this is going to play out in the midterm elections next year. A lot of that is going to be incumbent on what Mamdani does in his early days. What kind of messaging can the GOP, can Trump, can the Republicans get out to highlight if he does move forward with some of these disastrous policies? What can they highlight and really strike some fear into the minds, into the hearts of the American voting population? That this is now the Democrat Party. This is the face. If you're voting for a Democrat in the midterm elections, this is what you're voting for. That's going to be something that the GOP is going to have to work really hard on doing to make sure, if that is the goal and objective, that that is what they move forward. So we'll continue to watch that. I'm thinking thinking Tuesday night, probably do a live stream on social media, kind of looking at election results. So we've got municipal elections here across the city of Wilmington and some of our other municipalities, some interesting races across the country or across the state as well. Charlotte is a very interesting area right now. We'll take a look at what's going on there. And then, of course, some of these other races. You've got the mayoral race in New York City, the governor's election in Virginia and in New Jersey, that a very interesting Virginia AG race as well. So I think we're going to do an election night live stream. That'll be on all of our live stream channels coming up for you Tuesday night. At least that's the plan right now. I'll have better idea what I'm going to do Monday, so I'll let you know. But that's the plan. We'll do a regular show Tuesday morning, maybe about elections, maybe not, and then kind of just do a casual, chill, sit back show on Tuesday night, just kind of generally looking at what's going on, and of course, keeping an eye on those city elections here within Wilmington. Don't forget that the Nick Craig Show streams live weekday mornings, 7 a.m., YouTube, Rumble, X, and Facebook. We'll get a quick word from Wilmington City Council candidate Richard Collier. We'll grab a quick break, and economist Dr. Vance Ginn joins us coming up after this as the Nick Craig Show rolls on a Friday morning, streaming live and available 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Richard Collier. I'm an engineer. In my career, I fix what's broken, solve problems, and I build solutions that are made to last. Wilmington deserves practical leadership, someone with real expertise and a long-term vision. I'm Richard Collier, and I'd be honored to have your vote.
The Federal Reserve met on Wednesday to cut its benchmark interest rate for the second time this year. To walk us through some of the details on that and its implications, economist Dr. Vance Ginn joins us this morning on the Nick Craig Show. Vance, as always, great to catch up with you. This is exciting times. You know, you joined me on the radio for the better part of 3 years. I don't think we ever talked about a single interest rate cut in that entire time, two over the last just couple of months. What are you tracking out of the Fed this morning?
Yeah, Nick, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I mean, what we've seen just yesterday was the decision of what's going on. And looking at this week, what's happening with the federal funds rate, which is the overnight lending rate between banks, and the Federal Reserve, the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee, with the 12 members and all of their genius or all of their thoughts, I guess, they come together and they decide on the federal funds rate. And what they did was they lowered it, what we call 25 basis points, from 4 to 4.25%. That was the range it was in, to 3.75 to 4%. So what that does is it means a lot of the other loans throughout the economy, if banks are trading with each other, lending to one another every day at a lower interest rate, they can then pass that lower interest rate in the form of lower car loan interest rates, mortgage rates. And so it influences a lot of other rates throughout the economy. And so I think for the consumer standpoint, this can be a good thing, right? It's cheaper to buy things longer term and get loans. At the same time, it hurts savers, because now you can't get as much when you park money in the bank. And it could lead to inflationary pressures. And that's one thing that, you know, I like to, for us to talk about. But, you know, so I've got some mixed feelings. I would have rather them not cut the interest rate, to be honest with you, because I think the inflation is still running hot. It's still close to 3%. And that should be the number one thing on their mind when they would like for the inflation rate to be 2%. About half, you know, it's 50% more than that just right now. So those are kind of my initial thoughts of what's happening over the last couple of days.
Vance, we've seen these high rates now for the last couple of years. There has been some political pressure. The Federal Reserve is not inherently a political entity, but unfortunately, in this time, all things seem politics, whether it's a new coach over at LSU or what's going on with the Federal Reserve. Do you think some of the political pressure, predominantly from Donald Trump consistently scolding the Fed chair, do you think maybe that plays a part in this rate cut that we saw on Wednesday?
It certainly could. I mean, theoretically, the Fed should be independent, right? They're an independent agency. They have their own rules and regulations. They actually get funded by private banks paying fees across the country. But of course, it was put in place by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, which was the same year we also started our federal income tax. So it was a horrible year overall. We had Woodrow Wilson as president. There's a lot of bad things going on. But now with the Federal Reserve being in here for over 100 years now, I think what you see is just a small number of people making these large decisions for the overall economy really creates more uncertainty. And it hits a lot of Americans, entrepreneurs who are trying to decide what their profit and loss structure is going to be. And it also has, you know, got this political ball now going back and forth between President Trump saying, hey, how much are you building at the Fed? What are your DEI policies and or ESG policies has been a big one. You know, I don't think they should be heading in that direction. But at the same time, the president has kind of tried to jawbone down these interest rates because when the interest rates are higher, it means that we're paying more on the national interest on the debt, which is running about $1 trillion a year. The lower the interest rate, the less that's going to cost, and it can help the budget. But the trade-off is, if we get too political with what the Fed's doing, then we could have rampant inflation like we had during the 1970s and just a few years ago under the Biden administration. So I think it's a delicate balance between the two. But at the same time right now, I think we're leaning more too much on the unemployment and the potential cost from the tariffs in the economy versus what the inflation is already running hot.
Well, let's come back. We'll come back to the Fed here in just a second. You brought up the president's favorite word in the dictionary, the T word, tariff. He had a major trip to Europe or Asia, over the last couple of days, announcing some pretty significant things as it relates to the ongoing trade war, most predominantly with China, which has been in the news for the last 7 or 8 months. Maybe some relief on the tariff front, Vance, should be good news for U.S. consumers.
I think so. Let's see what all the details end up being, because what we've heard a lot from the Trump administration since the beginning of the year are a lot of frameworks of how these trade deals are going to go through. And with England, kind of the UK, really, but Europe, there's been these trade agreements in general, what we call a framework, but there hasn't been any specifics to what that is going to entail, nor has there been anything signed on a dotted line saying this is what's going to happen. So I'm still hesitant to go too far of saying what is in there, what's not. But it does appear that President Trump met with President Xi. Well, we know that, but it looks like they were able to work out some things on fentanyl, maybe on soybeans and some other areas, and possibly suspending some of the higher tariffs that Trump has put in place that is well above 50% on a lot of the imports. I think that's also a notion that President Trump understands that there has been a cost to consumers. When you look at surveys across the country right now, they don't feel like the economy is heading in a good direction. And we oftentimes don't see that under President Trump, especially during the first administration up until COVID and everything else happened, right? And so this is an area where I think the amount of uncertainty from the trade and the tariff discussion has stifled people, has frozen people from acting for longer term purchases and investment by businesses. And those things are slowing down the economy. At the same time, they're trying to create more money creation to allow for more growth. And so I think this back and forth of suspensions of tariffs, the hikes of tariffs, I hope will come to an end soon. And maybe, just maybe, this discussion with China will help to start that process.
Well, Vance, you bring up soybean, which happens to be not only a major crop across the United States, it's one of the top five cash crops here in North Carolina. And I don't think many folks wrap their head around, I don't want to get into an agricultural discussion with you. I don't think either of us are subject matter experts. But Vance, these farmers, these agricultural producers, they plan these things out years in advance, millions of dollars invested to grow their crop. They get ready to harvest and they find out, oh, one of our largest buyers in China is no longer buying this. Now we're sitting on 100 million pounds of soybean with nothing to do with. This is a major problem for the agricultural industry across the country.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. You got that in North Carolina. You've got Iowa that's getting hit hard right now. I mean, there are multiple states. You know, in fact, Nick, recently there's been some reporting about how 22 states, nearly half the states, are in a recession right now. And a lot of those are in the farming areas. North Carolina, I think, has been able to stay above that, but may not be too much longer. So this really hits hard. I think, you know, just we have a minute, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit about the tariffs. Tariffs are attacks on Americans. And so we suffer from that. I know that there can be disagreement or discussion about how do we deal with these trade deficits and other things. Let's assume that the trade deficit is wrong. I happen to not actually believe that, but let's assume it's wrong. The tariffs are creating more harm on Americans because we pay that tax, whether it's in the farming community, the ag community, whoever it is. And that's really hitting them hard. And the way that we're seeing that right now, Nick, is that the Trump administration is now wanting to put in bailouts to a lot of farmers and agricultural businesses because of the direct effect of the tariffs. Now, they'll argue that that's not the case and there's all these other things going on, but there hasn't been any other major change to the economic policy since the beginning of the year for farmers and the agricultural sector to be suffering so much. And it's driven, in my view, by the large tariffs.
Well, and you talk about these farm bailouts, these farm subsidies, and this isn't unheard of, Vance. We saw this back during the first Trump administration in 2018. So it's not something that this administration has not employed in the past. But let me throw this at you. And this is kind of where I kind of hang out on this. I think a lot of folks maybe are frustrated with some of these discussions over the trade imbalance. And I think folks are willing, at least for a short period of time, to give this administration the ability to negotiate and hammer out these deals. But Vance, as you just pointed out, we've heard from a lot of frameworks. We've got a lot of maybe handshake agreements. What we don't have a lot of is signatures on dotted lines. The clock's got to be running out for this administration to get some of these deals done. I don't think the American middle-class consumer can put up with another 12 or 24 months of the current economic conditions. What say you?
No, I think that's right. I think that is that's right on, that's spot on. And one of the things that I'm concerned about that this will be an extensive, like it's going to be longer term than what many people expect. Kind of like inflation was never transitory during COVID, which I kept mentioning was going to be permanent and persistent. You remember we talked about that for years. While most economists were saying this is all transitory inflation, you and I were like, no, that's not going to be the case. And I think right now, you know, Nick, these tariffs. I think initially the Trump administration, especially from the first administration, which I was in, was more about let's use tariffs as a negotiating tool to get a better deal and then we'll let them go. But this administration, the second term for Trump, I think you have more people in the White House who are okay with tariffs as being a revenue source. And we noticed that, right? Because they'll say that over the next decade, we'll get $2.5 to $3 trillion in new revenue from these tariffs. Well, that indicates to me that these are not temporary, transitory sort of tariffs. These are permanent, persistent tariffs that will continue to change the economic situation longer term, which is one reason why I'm hopeful that Supreme Court will rule against the IEEPA tariffs that were put in place from the Liberation Day tariffs under Trump to say that these are not constitutional, because I don't believe those types of tariff, which are like the Liberation Day, 10% across the board, not Section 232 or emergency, but just across the board tariffs. I don't think that is from the power of the executive branch, from what the Constitution and laws say. It's from Congress has the power of the purse. And so I'm hopeful that they will overturn these bad tariffs, and then that will unleash the economy after the one big beautiful bill, the deregulation that's happened under the Trump administration. Because one thing here, Nick, is, you know, I'm going a little long, but I think it's really important, is that the Trump administration has a lot of other things that they should be highlighting right now for more economic growth. Deregulation, trying to improve some with the immigration situation that was going on, the one big beautiful bill passing, but it gets sidelined, crowded out by the discussion of the tariffs and the negative economic effects of the tariffs. So in the first Trump administration, they put in all the tax cuts first, right? Remember Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and then they did tariffs. This time, they started with tariffs and protectionism and have tried to pepper in some pro-growth things. And the result is we're not seeing the economic effects like we had during the first term. And I don't believe we will as long as these tariffs remain in place.
Vance, we've talked about this in the past with folks listen to your podcast, they follow you on social media, or they've heard you on the show. You have been adamantly against the vast majority of the tariffs from this administration. You and a lot of other economists hold that stance. It is kind of an interesting thing to see predominantly on the right, the different philosophies and how to handle this. One thing I will say is that this administration tends to have a pretty good ear to the ground, at least from my vantage point. And Vance, yeah, he is willing to change and adjust. We've seen that in the past. The question is, how much longer before some of these lingering impacts that you're describing does this administration go, maybe we went a little too overboard with this. We got to give some relief to the middle class American consumer and start rolling some of these back. I feel like it can't be that far away.
I hope not. I hope you're right. And kind of circling back to what we're talking about with China, maybe that is what will help to start to unleash more trade agreements, because those are the two largest countries economically right now, right? And so if you get them on board in some capacity, that might start to weaken some of the other disagreements that are going on with trade agreements and say, you know what, we want to be a part of that bigger market. We want the demand. We want to improve our supply chains. And so, you know, maybe that is a point of optimism here, is that that could happen and then we see more things. I don't know that that will be the case yet, but I'm hopeful that we can end this sooner rather than later, because it's going to continue to hurt middle class and lower income Americans the most.
We'll continue to watch some of these either frameworks or signed deals. We'll keep an eye on those. Let's jump back to the Federal Reserve meeting. They don't meet every month, but they meet, it depends, kind of a weird schedule. It's like every 6 weeks or something like that. What do you expect for them coming out of the rest of the year? We're almost into November, heading up towards Christmas and the new year. What do you expect from them going forward?
The next meeting won't be until December. So if the federal government opens, whenever it opens, we might get some more data on CPI, which was delayed this time, but there was no jobs report for this month. And there probably won't be a jobs report next week for the month of October. So that's going to be missing 2 months of jobs data. Although I will say, Nick, we got to look at other measures like the automatic data processing, the private sector measure of jobs. There's a lot of other competition that's out there. We just usually don't use it because the BLS crowds out what other indices are looked at. But I think in December, what Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve Chairman, said is that it's not a foregone conclusion that we're going to see another cut in the interest rate in December. It's also interesting to note that we didn't have a consensus among the FOMC, the 12 FOMC members. One of them, Stephen Moran, who was recently put on there by Trump, basically, and he nominated him and was approved by Senate. He wanted a 50 basis point cut instead of a 25 basis. So he wanted even lower interest rates. And then you had one person, forgot his name right now, but there was one person who said no cut. And so now there might be some more disagreement about what happens between now and December, even though I don't know how much more data we're going to get during this federal government shutdown. So my hope is, though, is that they will not cut interest rates anymore right now. They will continue to cut their balance sheet, which remains $6.6 trillion. And that's how they manipulate the economy. But I also heard that they're going to stop doing that after November. After November, they're not going to cut their balance sheet anymore. And then that would be more expansionary or inflationary monetary policy. So it'll be interesting in a few weeks until we get to that next meeting in December.
And Vance, we've talked a little bit about this in the past, but I want you to dive in on a little bit more. I'm sure there are some internal disagreements within the Fed. You've got all the Fed governors and then, of course, Jerome Powell. But typically what we've seen is everybody kind of votes the same way. This is the unanimous decision. Even if you don't agree with it, you go ahead and vote along. Over the last 6 months or so, we have seen a couple breaks from that standard or norm, at least as I describe it. Is it pretty typical that the Fed is 100% in alignment on what they're going to do? Is this abnormal?
It is abnormal. Yes, they usually have a consensus among all of them that this is the direction we're going to go, whether you look at it during COVID or the financial crisis. During those times, you get near consensus. And I think they like to show that, right, in the sense of we're independent, but we also really believe strongly that this is the direction we're going to go. So we're going to support our staff. We're going to support what they've been providing us and move in that direction. But you do see these periods where some will be arguing like they are now, like not you and I are arguing, but I argue with a lot of folks that are out there that, you know, interest rates are still too low, and we left them too low for too long. And so they're going to be higher than they otherwise would have been. And so there's still these debates that are going on. The one thing that I think that they miss oftentimes is that they rely too much on the unemployment rate. Back in the 1970s, there was this idea that there was a trade-off between inflation and the unemployment rate, higher inflation, lower unemployment. And there was this trade-off. But Milton Friedman put that to rest when he won the Nobel Prize in 1978, saying that no, there's no Phillips curve trade-off. And the things that he talked about then, but yet we still live by that sort of model at the Federal Reserve. And so as long as they think that unemployment rate's too high, they're gonna be okay with raising the inflation because they believe within their models that that will bring down the unemployment rate. And I just don't see that that's the case from back then or now. And so we're in some tough territory. And the other thing, Nick, is that, you know, I don't think President Trump is going to renominate Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, who he was the one that nominated him back in 2017, I guess it was, maybe 2018, when he first went on. And so it's going to be interesting, too, to see the uncertainty about who the next Fed chair is going to be as we go through the next few months whenever his term runs out.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. We saw back a couple of months ago when Trump toured the new Federal Reserve building, a less than ideal exchange between those two. So, as you noted, yeah. Wouldn't necessarily be surprised to see Jerome Powell kind of be shown the door on that. Vance, there is a lot going on in the economy. We talked a little bit about tariffs and some of these Federal Reserve rates this morning. You track this stuff literally daily. You keep folks up to date on social media. You've got a newsletter and a podcast. Where can folks stay in touch with you?
Yeah, Nick, it's always a pleasure to be with you, of course. Thank you for having me on. The best places are on X, Vance Ginn, just my name. And I post on there every day, pretty often throughout the day, to try to give the most up-to-date information. But also my website is vanceginn.com, where you can find more of my research and blogs and more about me. And also, that's where my Substack newsletter is as well. So I put something out nearly daily with my Let People Prosper Show podcast and some other things. And I'm hopeful that your audience will check it out. I think there'll be some good information for them.
Absolutely. We'll throw the link to that in the show notes over at the website. Dr. Vance Ginn, economist Dr. Vance Ginn, joins us this morning on the Nick Craig Show. Always great to catch up with Vance, a wealth of knowledge. And, you know, we're talking about, of course, interest rates and tariffs and stuff. It is great that we can have these open disagreements. Vance worked in the first Trump administration. He was a top dog over at OMB. He's not an anti-Trump guy, but has reservations and concerns, I think like many folks do, about tariffs. So always appreciate his insight and highly encourage you to head on over to his website, Vance Ginn, VanceGinn.com. You can subscribe to his Substack, check out his Let the People Prosper podcast, a wealth of information. And if you are an X user, definitely go give him a follow over there as well to keep up to date with some economic data and economic news throughout the day. And always appreciate his time right here on the Nick Craig Show. Well, that's going to do it for a Halloween edition. Hopefully everybody has a great Halloween weekend. Again, weather looks absolutely gorgeous across southeastern North Carolina, albeit a little chilly, but we can deal with that. And of course, we will do it again coming up Monday morning. Thanks to the law group, Melissa Gott and her team, for their continued support. Visit them online for any legal challenges, lawgroupnc.com, or give them a call, 910-251-6088. We'll be back Monday morning, 7 a.m., YouTube, Rumble, X, Facebook, and 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great weekend. We'll chat with you Monday morning right here on the Nick Craig Show.